Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we were supposed to be having a chat with Tor Eklund, a US-based lawyer who specializes in computer crime and the CFAA. He was the defense attorney for Andrew Orenheimer, aka Weave. He's also defending the LA Times guy at the moment over CFAA charges. He's trying to minimize the sentencing. That was going to be an interesting chat, but unfortunately, when I spoke to him yesterday, he sounded like he was about to cough up a lung. So we postponed until this morning, and yeah, he actually got worse. So we've had to bump that one. So we'll just be hoping he gets well soon, and we'll bring you that interview another time. But the good news is I managed to book a quick interview with Troy Hunt of HaveIBeenPwned.com. And he's been noticing something pretty weird. Now, look, it's well understood that people used to deface websites for bragging rights. And, you know, I suppose it's not new that data dumps, are bragging rights as well. But it seems like these days attackers are seeing his site as the definitive place to get cred. They'll steal a bunch of data, and Troy is their first stop. Life is strange on the old internets. That is this week's feature interview. This week's show is brought to you by Context IS, a security consultancy and research house with offices in England, Germany, and Australia. And in this week's sponsor interview, we chat with Alex Ferrant. He is a senior security researcher with Context IS in Cheltenham, and we're talking to him about the risks of IoT to enterprise networks, IoT devices. But don't worry, this isn't some non-specific high-level chat that just says IoT is bad, 90s bugs, etc., etc. We're talking about real examples where they've managed to chain together a couple of bugs for serious effect. So we also talk about how enterprises aren't shy about making key company resources accessible over Wi-Fi these days. And yes, those being the same Wi-Fi networks that your vulnerable electric kettle and light bulbs are on. So that's happy days. That is this week's sponsor interview, with many thanks to Context Information Security. Both of those interviews are coming up later, but first up, as always, it's time for a check of the week's security news with our good pal Adam Boileau. And Adam, in an awesome bit of marketing, Zerodium has been making headlines all around the world for giving away $1 million for an end-to-end untethered jailbreak for iOS. This is, that's some pretty big bickies there.
Yeah, it is. It's certainly real money, although, and as you say, good publicity for Zerodium. Clearly, somebody's made some pretty fat cheddar out of it, so nice for them. But of course, the real story here is the fact that, you know, it costs $1 million for iOS remote jailbreak Zero.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't cost $1 million for a remote jailbreak on iOS. These guys chose $1 million because it looks better for marketing purposes, honestly.
Well, yes, but I mean, okay, someone, the market, and one person in the market chose to pay $1 million for it, which, yeah, exactly. It's not exactly the same as if it was $1 million.
But no, I mean, it's not.
Compared to the alternative, which is what's an Android remote jailbreak worth, which is, there's so many of them, it's hilarious and funny. That's the other half of the story. But good on Zerodium for milking this for all it's worth, and I'm sure getting their $1 million worth.
Yeah, now, of course, Zerodium was founded by one of the guys behind Vupin. You know, this is a big new business trying to make a splash. What I find particularly funny about this is there is no way on earth that any intelligence agency is actually going to want to reuse this bug, because its origin is kind of like not from with inside a contractor. Does that make sense? Like, so I don't know how they're going to get return on their $1 million for this.
Yeah, well, I guess it'll be interesting to see who they sell to. They, of course, say that they only sell to, you know, NATO countries, and that it's all, well regulated. As you'd imagine, Chris Sahoyan has some opinions about that as well. But I guess as a marketing exercise, they are, I'm sure, getting much return on their investment. As to whether anyone is going to exclusively buy it for enough to make it worthwhile, well, I guess we'll see if anyone gets owned.
Yeah, well, you know, we probably won't find out, will we?
But no.
Such an exciting and uncertain time. Now some exciting news coming out of the United Kingdom. And The Telegraph has reported that there's this horrible new law coming which will ban encryption on iPhones and Android devices, and they're going to monitor all of your web traffic and all of your URL history. But it's not quite clear at the moment, is it?
No, there's a lot of discussion and reporting about this proposed investigatory powers bill that they're talking about in Britain, which, you know, is attempting to kind of wrap up all of the, you know, the confusing current state of state surveillance of communication. You know, we understand how to intercept letters and phones, but obviously doing it in the modern world is very difficult. And we've seen David Cameron banging on about it, about how, you know, terrorists and pedophiles hide on the internet and we can't give them any safe space to do so. So therefore, something has to change. But it's not clear really what we're talking about, whether it's something in the style of, you know, what you in Australia have just come across, which is, you know, let's keep some IP address allocation logs so we can attribute who's doing what on the edge of the network, you know, through to this idea that end-to-end crypto, you know, is anti-democratic or something, and all of, you know, the government must be able to read everything you do, and, you know, iMessage and WhatsApp and, you know, everything else with end-to-end crypto will be verboten, which... Clearly, I mean, that can't be a position that a government would end up trying to go down. I mean,
no, because it won't work, and it's really kind of dumb, right? Which is why I look at the reporting and all the arm flapping, and I'm like, guys, like, let's wait till we see the bill because it's probably not going to be that bad. But you know, it is the British, right? So who knows? They might give it a go. But I think the latest thing I saw was doing the rounds on Twitter. I mean, this is all just sort of happening at the moment, right? So this is a developing story. From what I saw, though, they're actually considering keeping logs of which web servers you've connected to, but anything beyond like which web server it is considered content. So I think this is like a metadata retention bill wrapped up with some other stuff. We're just going to have to see how it plays out over the next couple of weeks, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, clearly there is a lot of hand-wringing that is, you know, quite plausibly not warranted. I made a joke. Jesus. But of course, I mean, from a technical perspective, there's a limit to what you can do, right? I mean, you inside TLS tunnels, you can't just see what else people are visiting. You're limited to SNI headers on the certificate exchange and some IP address data, and that's about it. You know, so we just have to see what the actual wording of the bill says, and then we can try and guess at the actual technical implementation, and then we'll end up with something that doesn't work anyway because anyone can run into crypto themselves. And so, you know, everybody who doesn't have anything to hide will, of course, be intercepted, and all the rest of us will just use end-to-end crypto like we are already.
Indeed. Now, I need to correct something. Last week, you know, we reported on the fact that this CISA law had passed the US Senate. Now, of course, in most reasonable countries, when something passes the Senate, it means it's a law. But now apparently they have to do some magical dance where the various politicians, their plumage springs up. And they dance around in a circle doing a special incantation while reconciling the House and the Senate bills. I don't know, guys. Get a more sensible democratic system. But apparently it's not law. A listener wrote in to correct us on that. So apologies for getting that one wrong. But, you know, when it does become law, when the special incantation is done and they've burned the sage leaves and whatever it is they do, we will surely bring you news of that. Bit of news that I scooped off Grux's Twitter feed actually this week, which is Egypt's military has arrested 150 so-called terrorists because they've been using the Telegram app, which is interesting because isn't that supposed to be secure?
Well, I guess this demonstrates the power of metadata analysis, doesn't it? Looking at SSL connections to and from things and, you know, attributing activity based on that, which, of course, is the future that we live in. But, no, it's interesting seeing this stuff really, you know, tied into very real world things, right? And anyone who operates any kind of service that purports to, you know, provide anonymity or safety or privacy or whatever, you know, you kind of need to stop and think that this is an actual real problem you're attempting to solve, not just, you know, playing on the internet.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, you know, I wouldn't put it past governments in that part of the world to just say, oh, that person's using Tor, go arrest them. That's a great example here. So we've got this very small report here from a news service called Al-Bawaba, which says some extremist group announced Wednesday that Egypt's military arrested 150 elements from them in the last operations after monitoring the coordination processes between them in Telegram chat site. So not quite clear if it's an infiltration or something more related to passive surveillance, but that is an interesting thing. There's been another arrest in the TalkTalk after the TalkTalk attack. That takes the total number of arrests to four. There's a 16-year-old who has now been bailed, and I think he's off to court in March.
Yeah, well, they definitely managed to wrap that one up pretty quickly. I guess their OPSEC was not up to the Grux standard, and they're going to pay for it, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, they're not in America, right? So...
That's true, yes. I guess they won't get, you know, 55 years in jail and that kind of thing.
That's right. Oh, and the internet's on fire. The internet's on fire. there's a great vBulletin bug, which is causing, you know, as the headline says, serious internet-wide zero-day attacks.
Yeah, no, apparently there's been a remote code exec bug in vBulletin for some years, and someone has actually popped vBulletin, like the company, not just the product, jacked the user database and is banding it around the place with whatever format the password hashes are in. I'm assuming trivially cracked, given the rough vintage of vBulletin. But yeah, it's used a lot of places. I mean, the defcon.org forums, I guess, are one that really stands out. They've apparently been taken offline whilst they figure out what's going on. But yeah, lots of people are going to get lots of owned.
Lots of people getting lots of owned? Because I sort of thought they would have been by now. Have you heard of many major ones getting popped? Or
I haven't heard of anything new, but the bug's been around for a while and it's clearly been knocking around the underground there. Like, yeah, I guess a lot of stuff has, as you say, already been well owned.
Yeah, well, it's like shit, use it before it gets burned, right? So it's going to be an interesting week.
It's fire sale time on vBulletin.
Now, Tor has launched what they're calling an anonymous encrypted IM client. This thing I've been tracking for a while. Obviously, I'm involved in Invisible IM and through Invisible IM Ricochet, which has been, you know, slow going on Ricochet. But I'm happy to report, actually, it's just been submitted for through the OTF's like security audit program. And we're led to believe that it will be successful in getting funding for an audit. And then, you know, because the new protocol is implemented. This is, you know, if you guys don't know what I'm talking about, go check out Ricochet Instant Messenger. It's an end-to-end IM client that uses Tor Hidden Services. We think it's pretty good. This, I don't think, is pretty good because it's using a whole bunch of vulnerable code. The interface is not exclusive to this product, so it's very easy to leak contact information and make mistakes. I'm somewhat surprised that Tor have sort of endorsed and trumpeted this release. It's I don't think it's a good idea, personally.
Yeah, so this is their instant messaging software package, which is built on Instant Bird, which is an instant messenger built on top of the kind of Firefox Thunderbird code base, which, you know, anyone who's been knocking around the internet for a while understands that that's probably not the world's best maintained, you know, best secured, robust piece of infrastructure. And, you know, building on top of something which is essentially an end-of-life maintenance modem, and Thunderbird is kind of that way, doesn't seem like the way of the future. And there's some reasons why they chose to do that from an implementation point of view. Like, you know, essentially you're running it in kind of like a browser, in that a lot of the code is written in JavaScript. So you get some benefits in terms of, you know, not being vulnerable to straight-up memory corruption. But as you say, getting this right and understanding the ways in which reusing existing chat protocols, XMPP and the, you know, the contact lists out of your existing chat clients, reusing those across Tor, there's quite a few things you have to understand in terms of what privacy you're preserving and what you're not, and where.
Well, exactly. And the other problem is you're still using an XMPP box somewhere, right? And there's going to be metadata there, and it's like, you know, okay, so you're obscuring your source IP, not much else. Like, it's kind of rubbish, hey.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than nothing, but the people who are using this kind of thing, you know, kind of need better than nothing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's my concern with anything that's not quite, well, I mean, anything where it's not clear exactly what properties you should expect of it. And I think that's kind of the case with this. Like, if people will look at the Tor name on it and assume that it does more than it actually does. And that's a concern, as well as, of course, there's, you know, a bunch of legacy baggage that comes with, as you say, XMPP and using off-the-shelf OTR.
Oh, and I love that. You know, they're like, hey, that's one of the things we've done. We've finally integrated OTR with Instabird. And it's like, you didn't just make things better. You actually didn't. That's not good news, guys.
Because, yeah, as I understand it, they implemented essentially a way to call out into native code libOTR from the JavaScript engine inside Instant Bird, which, you know, it's good. You wrote a whole bunch of stuff in JavaScript, so you're not going to get memory corruption bugs that are, you know, in the traditional sense. You get the usual JavaScript ones instead. But yes, then calling out into libOTR, which, I mean, okay, it's not as bad as libPurple, which is the messaging library that Pigeon and Audium and, you know, other instant messaging clients use. But it's still not had a great history. And anything that involves native code parsing messages, you're going to have a bad time.
Well, and this is why we didn't actually use OTR in Ricochet, exactly, right? It's because everything's encrypted through the hidden service. Everything's authenticated through the hidden service. So you kind of don't need it. So look, I'm not terrible terribly impressed by this, but, you know, kind of our fault for dragging our feet with Ricochet. You know, John Brooks, who's the key developer, he's had a lot on, right? So he just hasn't had a chance to do much beyond updating the protocol to a Protobuf-style protocol. I mean, it's out now. People should go play with it. It's unaudited, but it works really well. So hopefully OTF will give it an audit, and then we start pushing it, and this thing can go off and die in a fireball.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. Oh, look, here's a very brief one from Ars Technica about Start TLS, which is, you know, not surprisingly vulnerable to downgrade attacks, causing a bit of drama with some SMTP connections.
Yeah, so, yeah, specifically in the context of using Start TLS for opportunistic crypto over SMTP connections, which is a thing that we have seen a really wide uptake of in the post-Snowden era. A number of the big, you know, email providers.
Yeah, but opportunistic is not good enough when it comes to this stuff, right?
Well, that's the problem. Of course, opportunistic is, you know, if you can't do it for some reason or can't validate certs, and almost nobody has valid certs on their SMTPS connections, then, of course, you can get things in the middle. The main advantage of doing SMTP TLS is, of course, that passive eavesdropping becomes more difficult, and that's really the only benefit here. Anyone who's doing active attacks or is in a position to do active attacks can, as you say, downgrade it, and I don't think anyone's particularly surprised about that. But no. Yeah, for the passive adversaries, it's a pain in their ass, and we should still do it.
Yeah, indeed. Google has cracked the shits in a big way with Symantec over, you know, some time ago, Symantec, someone internally in Symantec actually created a cert for Google.com, you know, just as a test, and, you know, they really got annoyed. They've really gone quite angry at Symantec and said, you know, get your house in order or we're going to drop support for anything you sign. We're going to put big warnings on them saying, be careful, this was signed by Symantec.
Google have come out swinging and said basically Symantec must contribute all of their certificates to the Certificate Transparency Project, which is a log of certificates so that you can see what the CAs are issuing certificates for in a public setting. And they must start doing that, or yes, Chrome and Chromium will start, you know, not trusting their certs, or bring up a warning saying that, you know, Symantec are a bunch of poopy heads and we don't trust them, neither should you. I think Symantec is eating some humble pie on this one, because it turned out, of course, that they had actually issued a bunch more certs other than just the ones we talked about previously. Something like 2,500-3,000 certificates, I think they're talking about, some of which are, you know, for live sites. Things not all well in the house of Symantec, it seems. And yes, they are, by the look of it, kowtowing to, you know, Google's demands, and the world will continue.
Krebs has a really interesting little write-up, because it's one of those obvious ideas that I just hadn't thought of. It's a way to monetize, you know, stolen credit card information, which is, instead of directly kind of trying to, you know, buy goods and have them shipped to you and then relisting them and stuff, you set up an eBay account, you list something for sale, then when someone buys it, you use a stolen credit card to buy that item from the store and have it shipped to your eBay customer. It's a brilliant idea. It removes a lot of risk, you know, and for the customer who buys the thing off eBay, hey, they're happy. They've got what they paid for, right? The only person who loses out is the cardholder, who all of a sudden says, hey, I didn't buy a 55-inch TV. What the hell?
Yeah, no, it is. You're right. It's one of these really obvious things that, you know, whichever, you know, Russian cyber criminal, you know, thought it up and started, you know, selling it as a service on a forum somewhere. You know, really smart idea. Great example of innovation and, you know, disruption in the crime ecosphere.
Nice. The cybercrime ecosphere, I think.
The cybercrime ecosphere, yes. Yeah. But no, really smart idea. Great plan. And apparently there's actually another variant where they recruit other people to list products for them on eBay or whatever as a, you know, kind of work from home job scheme. So then there's yet another, you know, party who's happily getting paid in the process involved. Real a good innovation in the money laundering department. Good on you, Russian criminals.
Well played. Now, well played. We've got a bunch of stories here dealing with mobile security issues. And Adam, for the first time, I mean, I think it's been the last couple of months where we've seen enough news coming out of mobile for us to really have a better handle on what the actual threats are. Because we've been talking about theoretical threats for a long time. And now it looks like we've got an extremely well-established malware ecosystem affecting mobile devices, particularly in China.
Yeah, exactly. I guess it's a logical thing that you would expect given, you know, the growth of mobile as the dominant platform versus desktops or, you know, traditional OSs.
Well, also, but, yeah. China is the biggest smartphone market in the world now.
Well, exactly. And markets that have traditionally not so robustly controlled supply chains. I guess that's a polite way of saying piracy. you know, where, you know, having legitimate goods isn't necessarily the done thing. And that's, you know, those two things combined together are producing a, you know, a real sort of perfect storm for mobile malware. And I guess there's two There's two main aspects to this trend, I think. You know, on the Android side, obviously the major proliferation of Android and the general overall software supply chain weakness of Android, you know, even legitimately obtain Android in third-party markets and stuff. And then on the Apple side of the fence, you know, us actually starting to see real-world attacks that get around Apple's ecosystem, you know, through the use of Trojan compilers and Trojan libraries. And, you know, there was a story this week about an ad library on Android that was pre-infected, like the SDK for using the ad network was pre-infected. And of course, we talked about the Xcode ghost malware, which infects the Apple compiler. So these are, you know, more innovative ways of getting your, you know, malware onto these devices that are otherwise well controlled. I mean, Apple's got problems as well with, you know, code getting through their vetting process because it's part of a Trojan compiler or libraries that are, you know, I guess they assume are fine because they're, you know, commonly used things. So yeah, it's an interesting sort of, you know, interesting time. Developed into a real problem finally.
Look, it is, you know, and I feel like we are here where we know what the threats actually look like for now, right? And they're tangible. And I think, you know, really for our audience, which is, you know, primarily the United States, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, for these types of countries and our types of listeners, a lot of them are pushing into Asia. A lot of them are doing business in Asia. You know, if they're working in financial services, like a lot of the Australian banks are sort of pushing into China at the moment. And I think, you know, CISOs around the world are going to have to be a little bit cautious because it might be reasonable to assume that a mobile phone is a reliable second factor or is a reliable app platform in Western markets. But as soon as you take that equation to China, you know, you've got some pretty significantly shifting variables to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. Like it is a different market and a different threat environment than we are used to. And I think especially, I mean, you know, Androids are screwed in both. Although I guess there's less third-party app stores in the West, but the iOS world, yeah, as you say, is quite different over there. And that's you know, that's a thing I don't think people necessarily expect.
No, I mean, the number of jailbroken phones in China is just like, whoa, right. So, yeah, there's this adware stuff that's rooting Android devices. There's, yeah, backdoored ad libraries. Google Project Zero has found 11 bugs in Galaxy S6 Edge. We've got a malicious Android app impersonating Microsoft Word document. That's kind of interesting.
it's quite creative, actually, like making a Android app installer look like a Word doc so you click all through all the dialogues because you want to read the doc. Good thinking.
Yeah, pretty clever. Then you've got Xcode Ghost, which has now got iOS 9 support, right? So that's being actively updated by someone out there. There's been a whole bunch more bugs in Stage Fright that have been patched. I mean, I just can't believe it. It was JDuck fired the starter's pistol on this, and it seems like, you know, the internal audit teams are getting onto it, but it's a bottomless pit by the look of it at the moment.
Yeah, no, really. There's a whole bunch more remotely exploitable stuff in the media parsing libraries. That's just bad.
Now, Adam, here is one for 2015. A lot of people out there are using ad blockers because, you know, they don't want to get infected with horrible malware. Other people are using ad blockers because they just feel entitled to content for free and they don't think that journalists should get paid. there's a company that's sprung up called PageFair, which lets webmasters drop some JS on their sites, right? And it will tell them how many of their visitors are using ad blockers. This company, PageFair, got owned, and then their JS was used to drop like malware-laden, like fake flash updates onto about 500 websites. So, I mean, is it comedy or tragedy? They say comedy is just what is it? Tragedy plus time. Has it been long enough? I don't know.
It is pretty funny though. Apparently, someone jacked an email account that was involved in running their content distribution network. Used that to, I presume, password reset something, gain access to the CDN, and then from there, Trojan the JavaScript, which is, you know, from a technique point of view, relatively standard. But yes, from an irony point of view, this is pretty funny stuff.
Would using an ad blocker have helped? Probably not.
Probably not.
Zen, meanwhile, has patched a 7-year-old bug, which was apparently a pretty nasty one. Is this another QMU thing?
So this was a guest to host in like the memory mapping. So really in core Zen functionality that apparently has been rolling around with hypervisor for ages. So I guess all of the spooks are, you know, throw that one away and get the next one off the shelf. This bug would have been super useful, I'm sure, against, you know, Amazon and everybody else who runs Zen-based hypervisor infrastructure. So pretty bad, actually. Yeah. I haven't seen an exploit for it yet, but it looked like it would be, you know, reasonably doable given root and a guest being able to get up into the hypervisor. So bad, yes.
I mean, what percentage of the internet, you know, internet connected servers would be running either VMware or Zen. It'd have to be the majority.
I mean, I imagine quite a lot by now, yeah. I mean, yeah. Certainly, you know, Amazon is one of the very big Zen users. I mean, the other, some of the other clouds vary as to what they use. But, yeah, I mean, virtualization is absolutely everywhere. And guest to host bugs are, you know, a really useful thing to have in your toolkit.
We'll see a worm one day, buddy. We will.
We will, I know. I look forward to it. It'll be a wonderful, beautiful
Keep
time.
Keep your fingers crossed. I've got another holiday coming up, not too long. a great bit of work by Duo in terms of an EMET bypass or EMET bypass. This is interesting.
Yeah, they've done a bunch of research on how effective EMET is at mitigating the specific example where the bugs are in 32-bit processors on 64-bit Windows. There's a compatibility subsystem called WoW64, which runs 32-bit userland apps on top of a 64-bit Windows kernel. And a bunch of the mechanisms by which things like EMET and, you know, other security tech is meant to hook functions is not particularly well defined in that particular backwards compatibility scenario, which of course a lot of people are running 32-bit browsers on 64-bit Windows these days. So it's not an unusual thing. So yeah, they did a bunch of research about how effective EMET is in that scenario. And the answer is not at all, which is bad. So really interesting work from
Duo. Does it make things worse though? Because that can quite often happen when you know.
I'm not sure if it is actually worse. There's a number of other areas in which WoW64 does make things worse. Certainly from a forensics point of view, having to deal with that, it's there's two registries and there's two Windows directories, and it's a nightmare to deal with. But I don't think it makes it actively worse than the exploitation scenario.
Favorite story of the week. Second favorite story of the week. This comes to us from MarketWatch. Yeah, George Kurtz, who was found stone, wound up at McAfee working with Dave DeWalt, went off and co-founded CrowdStrike. He tweeted this one, which is funny because he used to work with Dave DeWalt. But FireEye, they've had their share price go into reverse in a pretty dramatic way because their loss was something like 88 cents a share, about double what was expected. And so Dave DeWalt has come out and blamed China because they're not doing as much hacking as they used to. This is what he says. And this is also when everyone else is saying, activity unchanged, FireEye's like, yep, well, China stopped hacking and that's what's affected our bottom line. And it's like, what? Like none of that makes any sense at all.
It's such a great way of spinning it. Like you can just see them sitting around in their boardroom thinking, how are we going to spin this? Aha, I know. We'll say China's doing hacking stuff. But no, they apparently, future projected revenues are down, and as a result, their stock price tanked 13% or something. So somebody's not getting a bonus. Blaming it on the lack of Chinese hacking, especially when just last week, who was it that came out and said?
CrowdStrike, actually.
CrowdStrike saying, like, nothing has changed. China's still hacking all the things, situation normal.
But hang on. I just want to ask, like, who goes, China's not doing as much hacking? Cancel that purchase order for the new network kit. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, at any level that you try to parse this, it doesn't quite make sense,
No, it really doesn't.
Anyway.
Maybe people like pre-purchase incident response service, like consultancy time, so they've got guaranteed availability because they know they're going to get on and now they think they're not. Like, maybe. I don't know.
It doesn't make much sense. But anyway.
It makes no sense.
Anyway.
Oh, dear. Now, sorry to the FireEye shareholders.
Finally, we got a really fun one to go out with this week. A cyber psychologist named Mary Aiken thinks that there's a Freudian aspect to hacking, which is involving, penetration, and the whole thing's kind of a little bit sexual. Now, I wouldn't normally even select a story like this for the week's news because it's like, whatever. What's particularly funny to me is the reaction to this story of like every single hacker I know going, "This woman's full of shit. How dare she?" All of this. And I'm thinking, maybe they don't protest too much.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this, buddy. You think because we're penetration testers that it's all about sexy times, but it's not. We go to meetings, we write reports. It's very boring.
No, because you're a pen tester. Now, I used to say that pen testing is methadone for hackers, right? Like, it's close, but it's not quite the same thing. But now, I mean, given the Freudian analysis, I might have to say that pen testing is masturbation for hackers.
Well, I guess we don't really achieve a hell of a lot as an industry. So, maybe I won't argue with you quite so much. But no, this one has been making plenty of amusing snark on the Twitters in the last day or two. Of course, the thing that's really funny, and I think perhaps there is something to your theory. There is.
It's not my theory, buddy. She's the shrink. She's the one with the theories and the understanding of Freud, of Siggy.
But
she knows Siggy.
Unfortunately for her, and I think her theories may have more traction, if she left the bit of her bio which says that she is the inspiration for the TV show CSI Cyber out of it.
Yes,
that might help with
that. That would be an omission that I would recommend in future. But have you noticed this reaction? Come on. I mean, you know, the thing is, I wouldn't have thought there was anything to it until everyone's in uproar and it made me think about it. And then I'm like, yeah, I can see that.
You know? Yeah, well, you know, I guess we could protest some further, but no, maybe there's something to it.
Well, she says, my favorite explanation for the academic literature is a Freudian psychoanalytic approach to hacking, which actually conceptualizes hacking in Freudian terms, such as a cybersexual urge to penetrate. And there are castration complex overtones in terms of being cut off from the network as well. I might have to track her down for an interview because I think that sounds fascinating. And I'm sorry that some listeners might find it confronting, but yeah, there's got to be something to it. All right. Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Big thanks, mate. It's been great to chat to you, and we'll talk to you again next week.
All right, I will go back to my my penetration testing and other exciting things that I'm doing.
Go satiate your cybersexual urges, pal.
Yes, I will have to use up all of my cybersexual urges at work so that I can go home and relax.
Dear. That was Adam Boileau with a check of the week's news headlines there. Good luck expelling those urges, pal, before you get home. Now it is time for this week's feature interview with Troy Hunt. Troy does Pluralsight courses for a living mostly, but he also runs haveibeenpwned.com. This is one of those sites where you can go and check to see if your email address is contained in, you know, public data breach information. He started off uploading people's addresses into the site so they could go and have a look. So you can say you put your email address in and it says, yes, you've been exposed through the Adobe breach, or you've been exposed through this breach or that breach, Ashley Madison, whatever. So he just started off grabbing data from public sources himself. But recently, something strange has sort of started happening, wherein people have started coming to him with the data often before it's been made public. That was the case recently when someone came to him with data belonging to Triple O Web Host. This is a breach that we spoke about in the news segment briefly last week. 13 million credential pairs with plain text passwords were made available. So in this case, Troy actually wound up working on notifying the company of the breach. I'll link to his blog post about the experience because, you know, as he says in this interview, it really was a comedy of errors. It's genuinely funny stuff in a slapping your forehead sort of way. But that's not really the weird part. The weird part is these days, apparently, having your data dump publicized by Have I Been Pwned is a great way for attackers to earn bragging rights. It's not what Troy had in mind when he set up the site. It's sort of turning into paste bin for data dumps, or like Zone H for creds. Some of you will remember Zone H, which was a defacement archive that wound up turning into this like trophy hall for defacement crews, which made the guy who started it feel a little bit uncomfortable in the end. Anyway, Troy joined me via Skype from Seattle, where he's attending Microsoft's MVP Summit. And he started off by explaining what happened in the Triple O web host case. Here he is.
So someone came to me on the quiet and said, look, here's this data. And a lot of this happens, right? A lot of people go, I've got this breach. And I go, yeah. And I take a look at it. But this didn't have the smell of fabricated breach. The accounts that were in the breach were confirmed by Triple O web host via various enumeration risks on their site that they existed. And like all the dots were joining up that this looked legit. So I tried to get in touch with them privately because this was 13 million accounts with plain text credentials. And that's a serious breach.
Mm. Yeah, you could say that. But yeah, you didn't have much luck, did you?
No. And look, I tried every way I could find to get in touch with them. And it was just a parody of or comedy of errors. Like, you know, web forms in Contact Us is not submitting properly. Not being able to sort of get through to tech support, not having any other offline contact details. The only offline contact details they had actually was a fax number, which I wasn't going to resort to.
And when I will not stoop that low.
It was apparently a 24-hour-a-day facsimile, which was something. But when eventually I did get through to them, and I said, look, this is the situation, and here is verifiable evidence that you guys can check on your back end. Everything went quiet and they just would not talk.
And then they reset everyone's passwords and said, job well done.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's eventually, so I was trying, I eventually got in touch with a journo I'd worked with a little bit in the past as well, and he tried various channels. He spoke to one of their parent companies. They dismissed him. He left a message on their Facebook page. They deleted it. And then eventually they went, okay, well, we'll just reset everyone's password.
Now, I'm wondering, though, Troy, if you think that it's possible that the person came to you who came to you had already been to them. Is that likely?
No, in fact, it's quite interesting the way it panned out. I'm very confident it was a kid, and not just in that colloquial younger than us sort of kid sense, but probably a young teenager. The individual sort of said, look, to be honest, his motives were a bit odd, but sort of said, oh, look, I know you're going to disclose this anyway, but I'd rather you not. And it's like, yeah, of course I'm going to disclose it. And then afterwards, when it started hitting the press as well, he was obviously scared shitless because he's contacting me going, you know, can you delete all the emails? You know, I'm worried I'm in trouble now and everything. And, you know, clearly the ramifications of dealing with this sort of data had never been quite clear to him.
So, Troy, pray tell, how did this kid come to be in possession of 13 million plain text credentials? Because that's a reasonable question to ask, I would think.
Yeah, look, I mean, he seems to sort of frequent these locations where there is a lot of trading of data going on. So there are definitely many times where people will approach me as well and say, look, I have got ABC breach. I will give it to you if you give me something else. So there is a definite trading sort of scenario going on here. So he'd obviously come across it in that capacity somehow. Now, I don't know what he gave up in order to get that or how he'd managed to sort of establish his credibility, if you like, in order to be able to do that. But it was obviously just swapping data. I highly doubt he was the individual that actually breached it in the first place.
Yeah. Now, it was a bit of an odd situation, I understand, for you to actually be the first point of contact for breach information, because that's not really why you set up Have I Been Pwned. I mean, the reason you set that up was to scrape Pastebin and throw credentials in that way, but you're kind of turning into an accidental cert.
Well, this is part of the challenge, right? So people sort of see it and they go, oh, well, this is a point where we can do disclosure. And normally what I'll say when people approach me and they say, look, I've got a breach, I'll say, is it in the public domain? Has it been covered by the press? Are they aware? You know, I don't want to sort of be your proxy, if you like, for dumping this stuff. And it's just odd that people sort of approach me with this when they have compromised the system. And what I'm really conscious of is I don't want it even to be the avenue by which people can get bragging rights or kudos for being able to have compromised something.
But that's what I find really fascinating about this situation, right, is you've got people who are owning stuff just to get it onto your site.
Look, I hope it's not quite that direct, but there are certainly people that are owning it and, you know, for all the usual motivations and then possibly going, hey, look, this is just one avenue where I can get some more airtime. And I don't want it to descend into that because I don't want these guys being motivated at all by that.
But, I mean, like, if you've owned some database, right, full of all of this personal information, it's useful information. Giving it to you makes it worthless. So what possible other motivation is there except for these guys to get bragging rights by talking about it, you know, online in various places and actually getting that data submitted and accepted by you?
Well, that sort of is the motivation, isn't it? The talking online and the big noting, because certainly we saw a lot of this sort of stuff before I came along. I mean, this service I set up was in response to Adobe, and there's 152 million records just dumped publicly, whereupon they become useless in the context of reselling them. Mm. And that was sort of, you know, well before this service. So there is definitely this sector of the industry where they just want the reputation, you know, they want the chivo of having gone, hey, look, I've popped so and so, here you go.
So what you're saying is that you're encouraging hackers.
Well,
that's what you're saying, isn't it, Troy Hunt? That's what you're saying. You've become the ringleader in the criminal circus.
Conjecture. No, that's look at I think that they may be using that as one other avenue of exposure for what they've done, which is, you know, clearly something that I've got to be careful not to encourage in any way whatsoever, whilst by the same token, you know, take a case like Triple O Web Host. 13 million people don't know their credentials are floating around, so I want to be able to help those guys without incentivizing anyone else to do the same thing.
So did you ruin anyone's day by publishing this 000 web host? I mean, surely this kid, you know, has come across this data somewhere somehow and has ruined it for everyone else. I mean, do you get feedback from people saying, you know, like Krebs-style hate mail saying that they're going to, you know, send heroin to your house and things like that for ruining their party?
Yeah, I haven't received any drugs or floral wreath or anything yet. And, you know, my wife might be having words if we do, so hopefully it doesn't come to that. But there are definitely a few different instances where people said, look, this is information that we have been selling or that has been private sort of amongst our community, and we're not happy with you making it public. And there are sort of multiple instances of that. There's another site as well, which is on the Clear Web, which lists this information for sale. And interestingly, it was listing it at $1,500 a pop, and then it went public and it went down to $200. So I probably didn't make them all happy. But, you know, there's clearly a market for it, and there are clearly groups that are strongly motivated by the ability to sell that. And let's be honest, it's only to the detriment of the people that are in the breach, so that you've got to be disadvantaging someone in order to make money out of it. And they're not real happy when it gets press, either because the breach gets distributed and the value goes down because now there's a lot more supply, or the people who are in the incident now get wind of it and they take appropriate measures such as changing their other credentials.
See, so, this is the thing that I find really weird, right? They don't mind that the entire data set is floating about somewhere. They don't like the publicity. They don't like it being publicized because you don't even make this data accessible. It's the media they don't like.
Well, this is the thing, but once it gets socialized like this and the word is out there, there are probably not 13 million people who just realized their credentials were compromised, but, you know, maybe it's a few hundred thousand or a million or something who now know the password that I used on 000 web host has now been compromised and I need to change it on other accounts, which is sort of the reason people are buying these breaches when it's just credentials and not other sort of PII. Because they want to compromise the other accounts. And that opportunity gets taken away once people start resetting passwords.
But as you say, I mean, it's only going to be, you know, a few hundred thousand, maybe a million out of 13 mil. I mean, how much is it actually devaluing that data set?
Well, again, I did see it listed at about 1,500 and then it went down to a couple of hundred. So, you know, I guess it's, what's that, like 15% or something like that? Or 85% devalued, quite a bit.
Yeah, it's funny that. I mean, I know of some pen testers who've had data dumps from various places to use in pen tests. Like they sort of use it as a giant, you know, lookup table to say, oh, well, here's a corporate user. Do I have their password? And they just, you know, they go through their own private copy of something similar to what you've set up.
Well, that's exactly what it is, right? So, and I mean, it's just amazing that I've had an argument in the comments section with someone just yesterday where they're going, you know, the data is useless anywhere else. Well, no, it's very useful because we as these fallible humans keep reusing the credentials. And if I wanted to go and try and brute force someone's account, I'd be starting with the passwords from their other data breaches.
Mm. All right, Troy Hunt, thank you very much for jumping in at the last minute to have a bit of a chat to us about your experience trying to disclose the 000 web host breach of last week or the week before. It's all very interesting stuff, and I hope you don't get arrested for operating some sort of website that promotes data breaches.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Pat.
Troy Hunt of HaveIBeenPwned.com there. Big thanks to him for doing that interview at the last minute. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and each week one of our sponsors gets to come onto the podcast to show you all just how clever they are. And this week it's Context Information Security's turn. Context.IS is headquartered in London but has offices all over England as well as in Germany and Australia. They're a security consultancy and research house and they do great work. This week, we're speaking with Context's senior security researcher, Alex Ferrant, about IoT. But as I said in the intro, don't worry, we're not doing a generic IoT is bad segment. You know, we're talking about some specifics here. Context.IS recently chained two bugs together to disable a smart home alarm system made by Yale. Start with the smart light bulb, then send one post request to a HTTP server on the inside, and you've disabled the alarm. So now that IoT vulnerabilities are actually becoming quite useful, I started off by asking Alex to describe what he thinks a win looks like when it comes to IoT hacking. Here's what he had to say.
For us, it will be not just information disclosure, such as sensitive secrets, such as your Wi-Fi password or banking credentials. It's also root access. If you can get comfortable on that box and have yourself a staging post from which you could launch further attacks, that is also an exciting opportunity.
People have been doing that with, you know, things like printers, copiers and scanners, though. People have been doing that for quite a long time. I mean, it seems to be back in the news now. Is that because it's a lot easier than getting onto some of these traditional footholds?
Absolutely. The attack surface of these things has grown exponentially, not just wired, but wireless. There's lots of different ways you can poke and touch at these devices now. So there's no shortage of options. You just have to look at some of our recent entries on the blog there, from the light bulbs to the printer, to see that there's things that in the past were just dumb objects, but now you can actually have wins with those and get comfortable, extract secret information, and in the case of a printer, upload your own firmware and get comfortable on there.
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was the Canon firmware Trojan some time ago that was pretty epic. Someone put Doom on it. Was that you guys?
Yes, Context did that. So one of our guys, Mike, he's done a very good write-up of this on our blog. He was able to abuse the firmware update feature on the printer, which sadly wasn't protected with any authentication. So he changed the proxy settings on the printer remotely using CSRF, and from there pulled down our own firmware image, which allowed us to start installing Doom. The hardest part of that was compiling Doom for ARM, because it didn't have any of the libraries required. So there was a lot of work to do to get that fun demo going.
So in terms of concrete wins, I mean, Doom on a printer is all fun and it got a lot of PR for you guys and a lot of headlines. But, you know, why don't you walk us through some scenarios where you can actually use this in anger? I mean, there was the recent case where a group of researchers drove around England de-orthing WPA kettles, you know, like smart kettles, and they were actually managing to grab network keys off them by, you know, springing up a, you know, false SSID and then tricking it to connect to them. So then bang, they've got the wireless network, right? So that was a cool concrete example. What are some others that you can tell us about from where you guys have used IoT for an actual win in terms of using it to propagate an attack?
Sure. So what I'll do is I will use two examples of things that we've looked at in the past, the smart bulbs and the Yale smart alarm, both of which you can find on our blog there. And I'll link them together to create a scenario by which these vulnerabilities could have a real world impact. So with the smart bulbs, we were able to exploit the onboarding process of adding a new bulb to the network, and from there effectively get your Wi-Fi pre-shared key, which isn't good. So let's assume now that we've done that and we've now got your Wi-Fi pre-shared key. Next stage, we're accessing your wireless. And this house building that we want to get into has a smart alarm. From there, we can exploit the control panel, which we found to be vulnerable on the smart alarm, and just switch off the alarm.
So what were those vulnerabilities? Were they typical web app, horrible SQLI, or, you know, those sort of bugs on it? So once you get on the wireless, on the wireless network, you can just do that? Or
I would love to tell you that there was some complex SQLI or similar, but in fact it was just a HTTP post to an undocumented API to switch off. It was a disarm equals one. It was that complex.
That doesn't even qualify as hacking.
Not really. No. It's more just looking at people's things and pointing out how stupid they are. In some cases, you clearly do require to apply a lot more effort, but we were certainly disappointed with the smart alarm at how easy it was.
Yeah, I mean, again, though, you know, that assumes that you're on the wireless network, that you can connect to it. But, you know, that was when I read that thing about the kettle the other week. I thought, well, you know, this is pretty handy because it does get you access to a lot of stuff. And eventually you're going to come across a device that maybe has wireless enabled and is plugged into Ethernet somewhere, right? I mean, is that common? Are you seeing some of these IoT things pop up with multiple interfaces? So they've got a wireless interface and they've got an Ethernet cable plugged into them as well. Is that something you've come across?
Yes, absolutely. And we're sitting on a piece of research we've just done, which I can't disclose, but I can tell you a bit about. And that is just such a device that has a wired and a wireless interface. And it was interesting because of that. And by having those multiple interfaces, as we will demonstrate in the near future, it's actually more vulnerable. You've just opened up the attack surface. You mentioned the alarm being on the LAN. Well, yes, we can get at things remotely using CSRF, which we've done for this recent post, which we haven't disclosed yet, and also the printer. By using CSRF, we can touch these devices remotely.
But, you know, a CSRF bug, that's going to require a bit of user interaction, right? You're going to need to send an email to the person inside the house who's going to have to click on the link while they're inside the house, yeah?
Not just an email. It's just JavaScript. So you could just have a watering hole attack. You could just seed a popular news website with a piece of JavaScript, and the JavaScript will perform reconnaissance on the LAN of every person who visits it.
So you could do some ad network attack and just turn off everyone's alarm. That'd be fun.
Yeah. Or in the case of the one that we haven't published yet, you can root the device and get reverse shell.
Everyone loves shells.
Yeah. And without giving too much away, this was made possible through nothing more complex than a directory traversal, which is a fairly old vulnerability.
You're busting out all of the golden oldies today.
Yeah. So this is an old vulnerability in a new piece of tech.
So one of the things that worries me at the moment, right, is that because WPA is pretty good, it seems that people have got a little bit complacent in terms of what they let onto their wireless network. I remember when Wi-Fi first was in vogue in enterprise networks, they sort of set it up as a little play area. You know, it was just like a little fun zone for people to connect and, you know, get out to the internet, but they couldn't really connect to corporate resources. Are you seeing that? Excuse me. Are you actually seeing people separate things that way, or are people just throwing everything onto the wireless LAN at the moment? Because it seems these IoT things, right, that's where they're at their weakest, is when they're on the wireless network, you can kind of, you know, trick them.
Yeah, we see an awful lot of complacency, and most of the time we're able to exploit something like a wireless protocol like 802.15.4, which is encrypted with AES by design. But we were able to exploit that because of a really poor implementation with a really weak password, which was hard-coded in every single light bulb. But there's certainly a lot of complacency with Wi-Fi these days, and people just don't even bother looking at what wireless clients there are. They just assume there's lots, and wireless congestion is a pet hate of mine just because of the ignorance that surrounds that, because people will buy wireless devices that use unmanaged spectrum and it's invisible. There's lots of devices there, but you just don't see them. And the waveforms they're using, they sit below the noise floor. They're spread spectrum signals. So if you were to try and do a survey to get a handle on what was inside your organization, you wouldn't know.
Yeah, we've done some interviews along those lines over the years, you know, even with the guys who make the pwn plug and stuff like that. And, you know, doing a site audit, you know, it's hard, right? Especially when you start throwing cellular devices into the mix. But I guess, you know, I guess I'm wondering, when you guys are on a client site, how often are things like the corporate file shares and, you know, corporate databases actually accessible over the Wi-Fi network? Is that depressingly common?
Afraid so, yeah. And as is often the case, it's the fault of the more senior members of the company who want to have an iPad.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't need to access the corporate database over the iPad, do you? I mean, you know,
not initially. When these things are rolled out, bring your own device policies. They're always rolled out with the best intentions, and the architect will say, "We'll separate this, we'll separate that," and then 3 months later, he moves on to another job and another guy comes along and says, well, let's just add a rule so you can get your dashboard from there.
Yeah. So what's the solution, though? Is the solution to kick the IoT things off the wireless network, or is the solution to kick the corporate things off the wireless network? Because something has to go. You can't mix these two things. So which things should go, do you think?
It's a very hard problem, and it's one many companies are really struggling with, because even if they don't have official BYOD policies, They have these unofficial policies which are even more dangerous. And so you just have this no man's land of a corporate network with personal devices on it, or vice versa. And it's very hard to draw the line unless you're on a sort of government or a military network, in which case you just apply a very strict whitelist access only policy.
That was Alex Ferrant there of Context Information Security. Big thanks to Context.is for its support of the Risky Business Podcast. Do get in touch with them if you have pens to test or things that you would like evaluated. They are very clever and they will help you. England, Germany and Australia, Context Information Security, Context.is. And that is it for this week's show. This week's feature track is by a local band called Pilots. They got a new track out. It's called On and On, and you can get it on iTunes. It's radio-friendly indie pop. I guess that's what you'd call it. I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.